So just to make sure you know you're in the right place, this is the Innovating with Nature Eco-Based Adaptation to Climate Risk panel. You're in Ballroom C, Capitol Ballroom C. I'll introduce the panel and myself in a moment while you get settled. I guess I should pull this up. Okay. Very quickly, a couple of things to start off with before we get to our panel, the meat of the discussion. I'm sure most, if not all of you, followed last year's Paris talks, and we know from that agreement that the world is sending some kind of a signal that it's not only important to turn a corner towards a low-carbon future, but also to fund adaptation to climate impacts that are already on the way. And that's really the genesis of this panel. But our focus here today is going to be on the ways in which nature-based resilient solutions can be used in place of or to complement man-made infrastructure for adaptation. You'll forgive me for starting with a joke. I didn't really start with a joke, but I think it's apropos. Two elderly gentlemen on a bench outside a fancy retirement community in Florida. One says to the other, what'd you do before you retired? Well, I had a fancy clothing store, really the best in the city, but there was a fire. I was too old to really start again, so I took the insurance money and here I am. How did you get here? He says, well, it's funny. I had a fancy furniture store, really the best in the city. But there was a flood, and I was really, like you, too old to start again. So I took the insurance money, and here I am. The other one turns to me and says, so, how do you start a flood? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Badoomch. Tuesdays at the Holiday Inn. For our first speaker, actually, that might be an appropriate question, because maybe not how you start a flood, but how do you pass a climate tax to stop flooding? Laura Tam, to my left here, is the bios, by the way, are in the program and online, so I won't go deeply there. But Laura is a Sustainable Development Policy Director at the San Francisco Bay Area Planning and Urban Research Association, SPUR, I believe is the acronym. Mark Schwartz, who is on the far end there, and I guess he'll be talking about the fire part of the equation. His associate director at the John Muir Institute for the Environment, and welcome, come on in, and a professor in the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at UC Davis. And in the middle here, our final panelist, Jessica Granis. She's the Adaptation Program Manager for the Georgetown Climate Center and a staff attorney and adjunct professor at the Harrison Institute for Public Law at Georgetown University Law Center. So I'm Adam Glenn with a whole catalog of bad jokes, if you need any, for family occasions. I'm also a New York-based environmental journalist. I edit two climate adaptation news services I'll tell you a bit more about later, and edit the soon-to-be digital SE journal. So, a couple of very quick reminders before we plunge in. This program really is about discussion with these panelists who bring a lot of expertise. There's also a lot of know-how in the room, so the idea is a back and forth. So I've asked them to keep their remarks to start very limited, just a few minutes, 5 minutes max. I got my timer here, guys. And then I want to encourage you to start thinking about the kinds of information that you might want from them. But when they're finished, I'll give a very brief thing about a couple of resources that might be helpful. Maybe ask a couple of questions if none are coming from the floor right away, but then it's really about the back and forth. You know also that under SEJ rules that SEJ members and working journalists have the first crack at questions, so blue badges, and also no speech making. I think you know that, and I don't want to cut you off, but I will. Do identify yourself when you ask your questions to your name and affiliation. There is literature on the back table, and speakers will make reference to it as appropriate, but take a look. and grab it before you go or now. And then just finally, we do like to gather feedback from these sessions. So if you have any notes about the format, about the speakers, about the jokes, you know, make a note, because you'll get a survey shortly afterwards and from SEJ online, and they'll ask you about the kinds of things that might make these programs better. So, okay. So let's just plunge in. We'll start with Laura Tam. I'm going to pass the mic over, and she'll get us started.
Great. Thanks, Adam. Can everyone hear me? Great. Hi, welcome. My name's Laura Tam, and I work at SPUR, which is a Bay Area-based public policy think tank. We've been in the Bay Area for 100 years trying to advance policy and advocacy and public education on urbanist issues and urbanism. Right now, we've been really engaged in housing and transportation issues, but over the last 10 years, I've been working on water and energy and climate change there, and so we have a whole bunch of stuff you can read about our work and our work to change the Bay Area and help to make it a leader in this area, and that's spur.org. So just to get that out of the way, I want to talk a little bit about something pretty incredible that happened this past year, which is we passed, I guess, what Adam is calling an adaptation tax in the Bay Area to help pay for ecosystem restoration and wetland restoration. And it builds on some, I'll tell you a little bit about what it is and what it does and why it's so important. But it also, it itself is builds on some pretty incredible and groundbreaking science that happened 15 years ago. So in 1999, over 100 scientists from the region came together and said, we have decimated the bay. Over 90% of the bay has been filled due to human activities. And we have lost most of our tidal marsh. And not only is our tidal marsh home to the largest migratory bird flyway on the West Coast, but we also have a number of threatened and endangered species. And we are losing our resilience to flooding, which is important for many of our human communities as well. So we had done a lot of filling and diking the bay, and these 100 scientists came together in 1999, produced a report called The Baylands Ecosystem Habitat Goals, and they said, we need 100,000 acres of protected wetlands to sustain the health of the bay. And that number united the scientific community and the policy and planning community around a goal to seek in terms of restoring wetland acres all around the bay. The challenge, of course, is finding that land and paying for the restoration. And so over the last 15 years, we were very successful at getting some federal contributions, state and other contributions, private contributions to rebuilding some of our bay wetlands. We have about 40,000 of the 100,000 goal, but that is obviously not enough. And a new report that came out just last year that, of course, in 1999, many of the scientists were not actually anticipating climate change as impacting what our ecosystem goals should be. So a new report revealed that we have to do this work a lot faster than anyone thought. We actually have to get close to that 100,000 number in the next 15 years, or we don't have much resilience left in the bay for managing sea level rise. So that really incited the environmental community to figure out a way to pay, to figure out how are we going to attract resources to all this restoration work that we want to do. And what we have been working on for over 5 years and successfully passed in June was a 9-county parcel tax of $12 per parcel that would fund, raise $25 million a year for 20 years to dedicated to restoring the bay through a program that would not only provide for pollution prevention and habitat enhancement, but also flood protection and shoreline public access and education to help people more enjoy the bay and see what their money's paying for. So in June, we passed Measure AA. It was built on a new joint powers authority, which is a special kind of government that you can establish in California, whose sole purpose is to raise money for wetland protection. It was the first time all 9 counties of the Bay Area voted on a measure together, so there is an interesting benefit of regionalism that has come with this. The measure passed overwhelmingly with 70% of the vote. It had to get a two-thirds majority of voters across all nine counties, which is a pretty high bar for parcel taxes have to pass by two-thirds in California. And it passed with over 70%. And that is an amazing story. The coalition brought together environmental community, the scientific community, the business community, and many others who have realized that this was likely going to be a great public story. People wanted to be part of something successful. And although $12 was just a low enough level that it was something that everyone could contribute to. And it seemed to be an important contribution to attracting additional resources. San Francisco Bay is a relatively underfunded estuary compared to places like the Chesapeake Bay. So this is seen as a way to attract additional outside resources. And they're just starting to gear up because the tax will be collected for the first time, I think, in 2018. So a lot of planning is underway. There's a lot of details in the measure around where the money has to be spent, but it's a very encouraging sign for it's very encouraging for our region to have such support for the geographic feature that unites us, and it's a great precedent for regionalism as we try to go to the ballot with other funding measures to invest in other areas of infrastructure that we need as the Bay Area. So I'll stop there.
That's great, great place to stop. Thank you very much. We'll go to Mark to talk a little bit about how natural resource managing agencies think about climate adaptation.
Take sure. Away. Thank you. So on this panel, I seem to be the lone person who's at a university whose primary job is doing research, and I'm principally an ecologist, and most of my time in my research is spent thinking about climate change and how climate change may interact with things like fire in the landscape to affect change on forests, particularly in the Sierra Nevada, and what we might do about it in terms of managing toward the future that of forests that we'd like in this state. And so I was asked to talk about nature-based solutions, and I think in thinking about that, I have to put a couple things in context. And you might be thinking that I would be coming out with some technological suggestions for how we might get to a better future for forests, and I'm here to say I don't think that's the right direction. I think the direction that we need to be going is more social engagement in terms of how we manage our forests, that we need to be looking forward and thinking about what kind of forests we want in the state, and because we don't have unanimity on this, and there's a lot of loud voices that have very specialized interests on both sides of the fence that seem to be dominating the discussion. I have a handout in the back that sort of frames some of the things I'll go through in the next couple minutes. Basically, we have a condition now where forests are and fires are dominating our discussion every summer, that this year over 500,000 acres of California have burned so far. That's about half the size of the state of Rhode Island, and that may sound like a small number, but that's happening year in, year out, and the federal government is spending over $3 billion a year on fire suppression in this country. The state of California spends over $1 billion a year on this. It's become a really big issue to the point where Congress is now considering thinking about how they allocate money for fire management, because the money that we spend on fire management through the Forest Service now occupies more than 50% of their operational budget, which means that the Forest Service has less money, less staff to do other things like manage the forests in a way that we might want them to be managed. And this is a real constraint on how we respond to forests and fires. For example, in 2012 and 2013, we had two major fires, the Rim Fire and the King Fire, that burned up quite large acreages at quite high intensity, and that without salvage money from those forest fires, the Forest Service isn't able to replant areas and help recover those ecosystems. So the reason we have this condition is really because of what we call the wildland fire triangle. That fire is a combination of weather, ignition sources, and fuels, and each of those things are increasing. We have an increasing human population in and around the mountains, and as a consequence, we have increasing human ignitions, and most of these wildfires are set by human ignitions, accidental or intentional. That as a consequence of reduced logging over the last 20 or 30 years and the heavy amount of planting that was done the 20 or 30 years before that, we have a lot of fuels up in those mountains. And they're increasing in stands that haven't burned intensively. And that with climate change, we have longer fire seasons every year. That Southern California now is really in a 12-month fire season. That we have that, and in the Sierras, we find that those fuels are drying down earlier in the year and staying drier longer into the fall. And that we have more days in between that spring drying and the fall wetting up again, where we have high temperatures and high winds, the conditions that allow fires to get out of our control. So there's been, Cal Fire has responded to over 4,000 fires already this year, and it's just become a massive industry that we have larger fires, more fires, larger elevation breadth of fires, and higher severity of impacts of fires, and that we don't really have clarity on what we want to do about this. The Forest Service, the Nature Conservancy, and several other groups have been thinking about this idea of variable stand density management. And if we think backwards to how forests maybe looked in the 18th, 19th century, they were fairly open park-like with some patches of dense, high-dense stands. And if we move towards that kind of management, we may be able to reduce this high intensity of fire. Others are thinking that high-intensity fire is not a bad thing and that it's an ecosystem that's readjusting itself and realigning for the future. But the point I want to make is that we have snag-dependent blackback woodpeckers that are in danger. We have houses in the woods that are in danger. We have park-like historic old growth that's in danger. We have old growth species like the spotted owl that are at risk. And we have industries like logging that are at risk. And these are these multiple competing objectives. And in order to get to the future we want, we're going to need to have to figure out how to engage in a civil society and discuss this and create a plan for that future, because at this point we don't really have one. And I'll stop there.
Great. Thank you very much. That's wonderful. And we'll turn to Jessica for, I think, a perspective on some other locales. We've been talking mostly about California, federal, state adaptation efforts. Please go ahead.
Hi, my name is Jessica Granis. I work at the Georgetown Climate Center, which is a institute based out of Georgetown Law School that was designed to provide support to states and communities as they both reduce emissions and prepare for the impacts of climate change. And I'm a lawyer, so I apologize in advance if I'm boring and wonky. So I usually start these conversations with a picture, you know, a collage of pictures of different flood events from around the country. Call it the parade of disasters, if you'd like. And as you all know, watching the news, these events are becoming more and more frequent and more extreme. And we've seen flooding just this year in Louisiana and Charleston and Houston and Sandy before that. And I think from a journalistic perspective, and from a communication standpoint, a lot of times climate scientists and communicators focus on the impacts and what that's going to mean for our communities. But the Georgetown Climate Center, we like to try to flip the discussion and talk about what the solutions are and what cities and communities are doing to prepare for the impacts of climate change. Because if you focus on impacts, that can scare people and make them want to put their heads in the sand and curl up in the fetal position. And so some of the projects that we've been looking at where they are, you know, taking a nature-based approach. I mean, historically, the way that communities and states dealt with flooding and storm surge was to build up big seawalls and harden the shoreline. And over years and years of that practice, we've seen what the impacts of that are for our ecosystems, for our beaches, for our habitats. And so many states and communities are starting to flip that dynamic and starting to think about how we restore those natural systems that provide nature-based flood risk reduction benefits. After Hurricane Sandy, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development ran a design competition called Rebuild by Design, where they challenged designers to come up with innovative approaches to build the resilience of communities that were affected by the storm. And we're working with the grantees right now to help them unpack some of the challenges that they're facing in doing so, because they're all starting to learn that Kermit was right, that it's not easy being green. The two projects that I wanted to talk about today, one is in New York City. It's called the Big U Project, where they're taking the Lower East Side park on the East River and turning it into a park that doubles as flood protection. So during extreme events, it will keep those storm waters out, but they will also enhance the park to provide access to the water and recreational amenities so that in those sunny day, everyday events, this park will continue to provide ecological and recreational benefits. Off of the coast of Staten Island, they are restoring oyster reefs to provide flood risk reduction benefits to dampen storm surge while also restoring the natural oyster habitats that were there before pollution and water quality degradation caused impacts to those resources. And so that project will both restore habitat to Staten Island while also improving water quality, reducing erosion, and providing those flood risk reduction benefits. Other examples of where states and communities are starting to think about how they design differently based upon climate are here in the Bay Area. Boston both have regulatory requirements where large-scale new development projects, the developer has to look at how sea level rise and climate is going to affect the project and design it differently to be more resilient to those future impacts. Similarly, we talked a lot about flooding from storm surge and big events from Sandy, but many communities are also seeing increasing inland flooding from extreme rainfall events. Because of the success of Rebuild by Design, HUD did that competition again, but at a national scale. States and cities around the country were invited to compete for $1 billion in funding through the National Disaster Resilience Competition. One of the projects that won is in New Orleans, where they are using green infrastructure on a large scale in the Pontilly District to manage stormwater and reduce flooding from those heavy downpour events. California was also a recipient of about $70 million to implement a wildfire and watershed resiliency project and use biofuels to create energy in the Sierra Nevadas and Tuolumne Meadows, where the Rim Fire threatened water supply for the Bay Area and the state. Some other resources that the Climate Center hosts that may be useful to you all in your work. We have an adaptation clearinghouse, which has resources on adaptation, and it's curated by sector. So if you're interested in particular sectors, you can find resources on those sectors. We also track the progress that states are making as they implement adaptation plans. We have a state implementation tracker. So if you're interested in what a particular state is doing on climate change, we have that information readily available. We also have a green infrastructure toolkit that we recently launched that shows how states and communities across the country are starting to use green and nature-based approaches for managing stormwater. And we also work a lot on federal policy. As I mentioned earlier, it's not easy being green. That's because there's so much law and regulation between local, state, and federal. And so we have resources to help states and communities understand what the federal law barriers might be to these projects.
Great. Thank you very much, Jessica. And some of the material, I think, is on the back table for that as well. So while you're thinking about questions, let me just share a couple of resources in addition with you. I will attest that the Georgetown Climate Center work, particularly the Adaptation Clearinghouse, has been tremendously helpful to me in my work. I just wanted to take a moment. I'll just pass a few of these around, and there's some more at the back. I wanted to just share two resources that I think would be useful if you want to or are working on this adaptation beat. So one of them, which is what I'm passing around, is a new reporter's guide on climate adaptation. It's funded by the Reynolds Journalism Institute over at the University of Missouri. It launched last winter with the Paris Climate Summit, and the main aim is to help journalists better cover this story. There's an annotated database with sources, explainers, there are story angles to help you work across a range of beats, and since the summer, a regular series of news backgrounders. So when there's a kind of a climate, an issue in the news that relates to adaptation, we zero in on it and provide resources and ideas for covering it. Take a look. I'd love to hear what you think. I think it can be improved, and for working journalists, I'd love to hear your thoughts on doing that. Very quickly, I'll also mention something that I found very encouraging. As part of the Reporter's Guide, we also did some research this summer about how adaptation stories fly with audiences. Again, work with the University of Missouri, the J School there, and we did a national study of about 500 news consumers to look at the adaptation frame for climate coverage. And what it very clearly showed is that if we change the framing of a story from one that really drives climate change, it talks extensively about climate change, to one that focuses on the impacts, what's actually happening, whether it's flooding, inland flooding, or sea level rise, or drought, et cetera, and then how a community is responding, what we found was that all the readers were much more accepting of that. There was not a kind of a knee-jerk response which you often find to climate change, just that phrase and the politicization of, issue. The acceptance was even more noticeable among climate change deniers, which was surprising. But it suggests that adaptation has a kind of a healing effect and helps everyone become more accepting of the idea that we have to prepare for bad outcomes, weather extremes, et cetera. And so it's a strong tool, we think, for communicating as journalists and for other communicators on the need for responding to climate risk. So I'm happy to share the results. They haven't been published yet, but I'll share what I can with anybody who's interested in that. The other thing I just wanted to, the last thing I want to mention is something that I think could be helpful in terms of just what you do in your local communities in covering adaptation, just to show you what's possible. This I'll just hold up for a second, then I'll pass around. This is a do-it-yourself $50 sensor that my project in New York, which is called AdaptNY, covering adaptation in New York City, built in partnership with WNYC Radio, with a climate journaling platform called IC Change, and with a local environmental justice organization. 50 bucks in parts, a few hours to put it together. We built, in a pilot, about 50 of them, and we put them in homes in Harlem, and there's some literature on this, so it's called the Harlem Heat Project. And so we put them in homes in Harlem that didn't have AC in order to understand better what urban heat island effects meant to folks there. Particularly, we're interested in vulnerable communities, low-income communities, elderly, those that are not mobile, those that can't afford AC. And we've been publishing results all summer. It's really fascinating. The reason I bring it up, though, is that it's very, very doable. You can do it with your news organization, wherever you are. And urban heat is a rising issue in many locales. As a matter of fact, I think we took 10 of this. We built about 50 of the sensors and sent 10 immediately this summer to Los Angeles, where I don't know if Molly Peterson is in the room, but Molly Peterson, a radio reporter there, is using them in a community there. So if you're interested, there's a flyer in the back of the room, looks like this, or contact me and I can tell you about any of these things. But these are resources and ideas, I think, that you can take away. Let's turn to the discussion here. I have some questions that I can ask, but why don't we just see if there are any questions right away from the field. There's no mic, so we'll repeat your question, but keep it concise. Okay, while you're thinking of questions, which you'd better, because otherwise it's going to be a long, quiet. Oh, thank you, sir. All right, bravo. Okay. If there are no journalists, there's a journalist with a question. Okay, please go ahead. Great, thank you.
The question was whether adaptation and mitigation go hand in hand in restoring ecosystems, and gosh, one would like to think so. But In fact, it's been a bit of a challenge in California. So as you may know, California has a forest protocol that is helping us achieve the goals of mitigation through carbon sequestration. If a landowner can register a forest property and gain credits for carbon that's accrued through forest growth. And forests grow, they accrue carbon, and that most of that accounting is on above ground carbon. We still have a hard time fully accounting below ground carbon, and that's been an issue in wetlands and ag lands and other areas, grazing lands, etc. But one of the challenges we have in the Western United States is that those forests are accruing carbon, but that accrual carbon is increasing fire risk, and those fires are reducing that carbon. And so they are a little bit at odds with one another. And the prevailing view among ecologists, forest ecologists now, is that we would be much better off in terms of being able to protect biological diversity, to reduce fire risk, to reduce property loss as a consequence of fire risk, and reduce human risk if we were to reduce stand density in most of this area. We also may increase water provision through those ecosystems to valley communities. So there's a lot of goods that would come out of reducing that forest density. Mitigating climate change is not one of them.
I wonder, Jessica, if you have any thoughts, and it was Josh, you said, Josh's question, in the plans that you're seeing by local governments, how closely are they tying mitigation and adaptation?
I mean, it sort of depends on the plan. Some communities and states are integrating their mitigation planning and their adaptation planning. Oftentimes, what you're not seeing is where they're looking at the synergies between mitigation and adaptation policies and the conflicts. I think there are places where what you do on adaptation can provide mitigation co-benefits, like, you know, urban tree canopy and other things to create plants to sequester carbon. You have things like microgrids that are solar powered that have resilience benefits because they can be islanded during a disaster event. But there are also areas where you have conflict. So here in California, you have a drought, and people are looking at alternative water supplies like desalination, and depending on how you're powering those energy-intensive efforts to desalinate water, you know, you can have mitigation costs on that, for that type of adaptation strategy.
Anything to add now?
No, I was just going to say, in an urban context, very often there is the same treatment can provide both mitigation and adaptation. But Jessica already talked about urban greening and what a significant impact that has on reducing urban heat island and energy demand. Specifically, things like tree canopy and green roofs have a huge energy benefit that helps with mitigation and adaptation in an urban environment. But I don't know as much. I think that the wetland benefit that I talked about earlier is there is some mitigation in the storing of carbon in wetland habitat, but I don't think it is quite as significant, perhaps, as the adaptation benefit.
Yes, please go ahead. Do you want to field that? And just repeat the question.
Okay, the question is, what cities do you consider to be at the forefront of adaptation and resilience? I have three or four examples. I think San Francisco and the Bay Area are doing a pretty incredible job, but that's a hometown, so I got to say that. There's actually quite a lot of work being done all over the Bay shoreline in San Francisco, not just the city of San Francisco, but all around San Mateo County. One of the largest restoration projects on the West Coast is in the South Bay, San Jose and Hayward. There is a ton of research and a ton of really interesting adaptation projects in the North Bay shoreline where they're looking at creeks and the input to the bay there. So I think there's a lot of really interesting research science and adaptation thinking and a huge number of meetings and discussions around what are we going to do in the Bay Area. I also think New York, with its Resilience by Design competition, is recognizing and doing not just a design competition, but a lot of actual floodproofing of Lower Manhattan, of its infrastructure, of the subways and other things. And I know that in Chicago has a really advanced climate adaptation framework around heat, which is one of the biggest impacts that that city is expecting to experience. What is your take?
So I think here in California, you're seeing a lot of innovative work, and part of the reason for that is because the state and local communities are putting skin in the game. They're putting money to the table and helping communities do the work that's needed and providing technical capacity to help them do that work. And they're also starting to be mandates for them to plan and incorporate climate into their adaptation plan. So I think, you know, from San Francisco to San Diego to LA, here in Sacramento, there's a lot of great work happening on adaptation. From other places, there's a lot happening in the Sandy affected region. And again, it's about resources. They had, the unfortunate luck of getting hit by a disaster when federal disaster dollars flow and there's resources to do these kinds of innovative resilience projects. I think what's different about the Sandy storm is that they didn't, typically after a disaster, communities rebuilt what was in place before the storm. And part of that was because of the way that our disaster laws are structured, is it really doesn't allow communities to innovate. It makes you put back what was there before. And so Sandy has been an opportunity both for the federal government and for states to really think about whether that makes sense and to try to do things differently. So I think we're seeing a lot of innovative projects actually being implemented on the ground in the Sandy places, in Sandy-affected places. And places that don't have those resources that I think are doing some great stuff. Louisville, Kentucky is doing a lot on urban heat islands and managing that inland flooding from precipitation, and also directing and trying to use heat sensors to direct their investments to the parts of the community that are most at risk and have those vulnerable populations, low income, that don't have air conditioning and that are most at risk of being harmed in a heat event. Baltimore near us is doing some really innovative stuff around creating resiliency hubs, greening vacant lots and installing green infrastructure in vacant lots, monitoring those green infrastructure installations for their urban heat reduction benefits, and more that I could talk about, but those are some examples. Any cities outside the U.S., we tend to focus domestically. I think there's great stuff happening in the Netherlands, Rotterdam, interesting things happening in Australia and Sydney. But on urban heat and, using cool pavements, but less knowledgeable about that kind of stuff. But there are examples in our adaptation clearinghouse of international places that are doing innovative stuff that could be replicable here in the States.
An interesting resource for that, Todd, is the take a look at the 100 Resilient Cities Project, which is Rockefeller Foundation funded, that at least spells out some of the challenges and responses in cities outside the U.S. as well as the U.S. By the way, on Louisville, I don't know if Jim Bruggers is here in the room, but he's here at the conference, the environment reporter there, longtime SEJ member, and has done a lot of adaptation reporting. You might take a look or talk with him about it. There were a couple of more questions here, and then we'll go back through the room. So start here with this gentleman.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the question is, how far in advance can cities look to plan? That's a question a philosophical question that me and my colleagues have been talking about for more than 5 years. Like, how long, when we plan cities, we plan them to be around for forever. We don't think, is there an expiration date on Athens or London? We think about something, and in the development and design community, you think about building something that's permanent. And so this question of, what is the future of a city surrounded by water on three sides is really an epistemological question that we're wrestling with. And we think I think the city of San Francisco, which just adopted a sea level rise action plan in March of this year, it's actually a pretty thoughtful document you can find on the internet. that says the city is going to prepare by doing adaptation thinking out to 2100. So it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be building our infrastructure to be ready necessarily, depending on what it is, for 2100. Maybe if it's something that's only going to last 50 years or 30 years, like, we can live with the estimates around scenarios around 2050. But for long time thinking, like, we build a new Bay Bridge, should we be thinking about 2100 or beyond? And the certainty is very difficult. So I think it's a good question, and I think we're going to keep asking it for the next 50 years and more. But I think we are starting to see cities put 2100 in their time horizons as they ask developers to meet new standards around adaptation.
Other thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, just to reiterate, it depends on the decision that you're making. I think in most cases in planning, people are looking out to that 100-year time frame, but when they're making decisions about infrastructure, they're looking at the life cycle of that asset and saying how far to look out. Usually we look out 30 years. Maybe it makes sense to look out 50, because most of the infrastructure we've built has been around for way more than 30 years. But I think, you know, people are starting to think about where in the life cycle existing assets are and what needs to get replaced in the short horizon, and how are we going to adapt, retrofit, rebuild, relocate those existing assets, and think about, you know, how long out to look based upon the asset and how adaptive it is in itself. If you're building a bridge that you want to be around for 100 years, then maybe you should be using more precautionary numbers. If you're building something that's less expensive, than maybe a 30-year life cycle analysis is enough.
And just to follow that up, and maybe Mark, this question goes to you, but is there a difference in time frame when you're thinking about nature-based solutions? The difference between building a seawall and building out wetlands, for example, and then also what is this time frame question? How does this relate to natural assets like in park systems?
Yeah, so I guess an anecdote is in order there, in that one of the things that I've worked on over the last several years is working with Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park. And they, of course, are very concerned about giant sequoias. It's their part of their mandate. And people constantly call them and ask them if they're watering the trees through the drought. And so, in essence, they're saying, well, they have a responsibility for maintaining giant sequoias in the national park. Well, giant sequoias live 1,500 years or so, and it's not clear what kinds of climatic changes will kill the existing stands. But they are legitimately thinking about, should they be establishing new groves at higher elevations in woodlands, because to create the sequoia groves of the future. And this would be a massive shift in their management strategy, and so it's not something they take lightly, and it's not something they're on the cusp of doing, but it's something that they're talking about and thinking about their responsibility to stewarding those ecosystems. And that's thinking over, you know, millennia, not decades.
Right.
But maybe I could add that an awful lot of this wildland stuff happens at the county level, in rural counties. And a lot of counties are driven by their 20 or 30 year planning horizons, and that they're beginning to link ecosystem management to their growth and development plans through things like the California Natural Planning Acts that allow there to be a linked documents between growth and development plans and setting aside open space, and that this has expanded the horizon for thinking about managing natural lands in a way that I think is very helpful. And you have a few counties now, like Calaveras County, which is really thinking about how they're going to drive their county through the next 30, 40, 50 years to create a system of forests that are good for recreation, good for jobs, and provide water to the valley and are safe places to live.
Right. Jessica, please.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the coastal context, this is particularly challenging for a couple of reasons. One being that if you look at the sea level rise projections from the National Climate Assessment, they go from 0.6 feet if you're just projecting the historic baseline to 6.6 feet under a high emission scenario. And there's very little guidance about, you know, what number to choose and where are we actually going to be, and that none of that rise is going to happen in a linear fashion. And for coastal ecosystems, you know, that difference really matters. And so the way that, and I think the second challenge is that
from a permitting standpoint, it's not easy to do adaptive management of living shoreline projects or coastal restoration projects because your permit says these are the XYZ things that you can do, that you've been permitted to do, and there's little flexibility to change and adapt how you're constructing that project or changing it over time to manage that rise in sea levels. And I think, you know, there are a couple good examples of places that are starting to think about how do you design and grade a living shoreline project that can account for different rates of rise over time, and grading the project and monitoring to see how the project withstands changes in sea level over time. In Louisiana, they have the Coastal Master Plan that looked at restoration as part of the suite of solutions they're going to use to restore the Mississippi River Delta system to provide that first line of defense against sea level rise and flooding, and are looking at how sea level rise is going to affect that restoration effort. And the next plan that's coming out is going to increase their estimates of what they are expecting in terms of sea level rise. But this is a challenge that a lot of people are grappling with, is how do you adjust what you're doing as the sea levels change and your ecosystems are changing, so that you can continue to maintain those wetland restoration projects that provide those benefits.
Great. Thank you.
Can I just add really briefly?
Yeah, please do.
I forgot to say when the question was what cities are doing a good job, I forgot to add New Orleans in there. And the lines of defense around the city, the living with water approach to managing green infrastructure is an incredible story. And Louisiana's Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority has one of the best, I think, plans for adaptation and resilience building on Louisiana's coast of any state. And so that's definitely worth checking out. And I have some magazines in the back that are from our organization. We wrote a big article, a couple articles about this, and one of the magazines is exclusively devoted to New Orleans, so you can read more about it right there. It's in the back.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you. I think there was a question here. Please go ahead.
Yeah, the first comment on Todd's question about the 100 million
cities. ID yourself.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Susan Moran, freelance writer in Boulder, yes. Colorado. And I just found this challenge, sort of like covering sustainable ag or sustainability in general, but adaptation and resilience can be so fuzzy and so prone to hype. Not that it's deliberately a bad thing, but when I started looking into particularly the Rockefeller cities, it seemed a lot of cities were putting resilience and adaptation and proposals to get funded, but resilience meant everything. And it's not just about climate change. I guess my question is, I don't know, any advice you have, like for journalists to go for the real, for the probing stories that aren't just, I mean, I think it's great to write about problems.
So to repeat the question, I think really two things. One is if the panelists can address this resilience, adaptation, is there a difference? It seems fuzzy. What does it mean? And then how to get beyond the concept to the specifics of you know, how those are enacted for stories, for journalism. Is that captured? Okay.
Marketing,
right.
Yeah.
Not in this panel description or anything you're not saying.
No.
I'm teasing you.
Yeah.
This is a very specific panel description. But please, I think that is really important, that fuzziness is a challenge. And what would you guys say?
So I can speak to that. So I was part of the technical support team that helped the National Disaster Resilience Competition applicants develop their resilience plans. And so have been embedded with the Rockefeller resilience approach. And I think the differences are that adaptation tends to focus on climate change and being prepared for the impacts of climate change, where resilience takes a broader approach to look at city systems and to think about what makes a city resilient to both shocks, like extreme storms, extreme rain events, and those long-term stressors like crime and poverty that make a community less able to bounce back in the aftermath of a disaster. And it really tries to frame it in terms of how cities think about their systems and their silos and how they can increase their social and economic resilience while also ensuring that they're going to be physically resilient to those extreme shock events when they happen. So you're right, it is much broader, and it's thinking more holistically across the different parts of how cities manage themselves. I think one of the big questions for the adaptation community and the resilience community is, how do we know if any of this is going to be effective? How do we know if we are actually really reducing our risks to these extreme shock events? And part of the challenge there is if you implement it, then you're effective if nothing bad happens. So it's hard to report on that, and it's hard to cover that. If nothing bad happens, what's the story? And I think, an interesting thing that came out of the National Disaster Resilience Competition is that all of the 13 or 14 winning teams really had to come up with indicators to determine how are they going to monitor these projects over time across not only physical resilience, but social and economic benefits as well, and environmental benefits. How are they going to distribute and distill that information to show the efficacy of these projects that they're implementing? So I think over time, as the Rebuild by Design competition and the NDRC projects get implemented, there will be a lot more data and information about the efficacy of these projects and whether or not they are successfully enhancing the physical resilience, but also providing environmental, social, economic benefit to these communities.
Good answer.
Further?
I would just say that I would encourage you to probe what someone means when they talk about resilience, because a couple years ago it became the new buzzword, like sustainability was in the 90s. And one thing that personally vexes me about the term resilience is that it implies that the thing we have now is a thing we kind of want to keep. And it doesn't necessarily say anything about sustainability or whether we were on the right path the first time before we had a disaster. And so I think we have to think about, you could say, you could probe a little further with, do you mean earthquake resilience? Do you mean disaster resilience? Do you mean terrorism resilience? Do you mean climate resilience or social resilience? And in order to sort of get deeper into that term so that it doesn't become like a catch-all, because I think that the overuse is diminishing its meaning. Yeah.
Very helpful. Thank you. There was another question on this side, I think. If not, then we'll go. Sir, please go ahead.
My name is Peter Edel, CDC, Atlanta, Georgia. You've talked a lot about the role of civil society, states, counties, and this is very, very encouraging to me. What I would like to get from you is what, from your perspective, has been the role of the federal government, what have you doing well, and where could you do better?
That's an easy question.
So role of federal government in this field.
I'll jump in on that one, because I think that the U.S. Forest Service is one of the most besieged organizations in the federal government. They get sued for every decision they make, usually twice, one on both sides. And they're in a lot of trouble. We've broken the trust of the American people with Forest Service, I think, through the 1970s and 80s. And I think that they now are taking steps to try and mend that and rethink how they deal with people and make decisions. And so in 2012, there was a new planning rule that now guides how they do plans. One of the most famous forest plans was in the late 90s around the Northern Spotted Owl, and it went through and laid out 9 different options, and then the president chose one, and it was supposed to be an adaptive management plan, but there was very little adaptation that went on afterwards because there had been so much fighting up front about those different options that no one could really bear changing, and when they did, they would get sued. And so the idea with the 2012 planning rules, the structured more experimentation and more adaptation into the plan and engage more people in developing the plan, and with the hope that it'll be a more collaborative environment at the end of the day. And California now has three of the eight initial plans that are being done under the California, the 2012 plan rule. And so the jury's out. I mean, it'll take 10 or 15 years before we know whether they've succeeded or not. But I think that within my field of ecology and conservation biology, there's a huge move towards collaborative decision-making, engaging stakeholders in decisions, and the federal government is right on board with all of that through the Endangered Species Act, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Forest Service, and their decision-making, and I think that it's a healthy change, and time will tell whether it actually succeeds.
I can give you a bigger, the big picture standpoint. Yes, the federal government has a huge role. They provide billions of dollars in resources to state and local governments. They provide technical support and capacity building services. They manage federal lands, and there's a ton of regulatory programs that they administer that are sometimes the hindrance to state and local ability to implement. We have a report that we put out in 2013. President Obama announced his climate action plan, where he convened the state, local, tribal leaders task force to try to get input about how federal agencies can do a better job supporting state and local adaptation initiatives. And part of the rationale for that is that Congress has been pretty absent on this issue. And so President Obama knew that we really had to use existing federal programs and existing authority if we're going to start to crack the nut. And so he had a mandate to all of the federal agencies to start thinking about their own programs and policies and try to figure out how do they do better by their state and local partners and help them more in this area. I think since he came out with that mandate, there have been important steps that the federal agencies have taken. But much more needs to be done. I think some of the biggest barriers that we see in the coastal front that are, still needing some work are with the National Flood Insurance Program. The maps that communities use to regulate in floodplains that are used to determine whether or not you have to carry flood insurance use historic data. They don't look out to sea level rise. They are grossly under-predicting the risk, as we're seeing in these places that flood. And there has been work to think about how we incorporate sea level rise and climate data into that map, but not for purposes of the regulatory program, which is the flood insurance program. On the wetland restoration living shorelines piece, the Army Corps manages permits for that under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. And historically, there have been challenges navigating that process to get in nature-based approaches to managing flood risk and erosion. The Corps issued a nationwide permit for living shorelines in draft, but that's going to allow very small-scale living shoreline projects, and some of these larger-scale, like ecosystem restoration projects that provide the most flood risk reduction benefits are still going to be pretty challenging from a permitting standpoint. Examples.
I wonder if I can ask a question myself, and then, but please welcome other questions from the floor too about the money part of this. Whether it's federal monies that we've seen, or state level or local, how is this being financed? What are some of the more interesting and innovative approaches, including obviously the Bay Area tax that we talked about that you guys are seeing?
Any, how is what being financed?
Any of these adaptation approaches? I mean, nature-based solutions, of course, since that's the focus here, but any adaptation strategies that are happening at local level, that tend to be through what mechanisms? State level, what mechanisms? We just heard about federal, but a little bit.
I can start. I mean, I don't think there is a lot of finance for climate adaptation. I think that is an emerging area. And I think one of the reasons there are, of course, there is funding for, core projects for fish and wildlife, like for transportation projects, but there isn't necessarily a specific, there isn't resources specific to adaptation. There are rules, and one of the ones pertaining to the last question, the federal government just required climate change to be considered under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, which is the thing that you have to, the environmental review process for any federal agency to do any project. So that seems very significant and creates a climate condition for funding, which is something that we would like to see happen replicated more locally. We think, for example, in the Bay Area, we could be doing a lot more climate planning as we make transportation investments and things like this. But I think that local measures like AA are unprecedented, which is the tax I was talking about earlier, are unprecedented because they seek to raise broad revenue from the local populace to pay for some of the and leverage additional resources for the investments that we prioritize and want to make. But I don't think there are a lot of resources right now to do adaptation. We're talking about rebuilding a seawall in San Francisco that is seismically vulnerable, and just one little section of one seawall in one city is estimated to cost about $5 billion. It's possible that San Francisco is a wealthy city and will probably find a way to pay for it, but that's just one section of our very long shoreline in one wealthy city, and it's going to be incredibly challenging to figure out how to put the packages together to finance all the adaptation that we'll need, whether ecosystem-based or gray infrastructure over time.
Yeah, I mean, so I think the big challenge from the funding side is that there is no dedicated source of funding that you can go to for an adaptation project. And really, what most states and communities are doing is trying to cobble together existing sources of funding from the federal government or state programs to try to meet these projects that are really cross-disciplinary, cross-sectoral, cross-silos. And that quilting process is very challenging and often leaves big gaps, and so you aren't able to get to these comprehensive solutions that people are looking to achieve. I think the other challenge is that most of the federal funds are competitively allocated, and a lot of them are diminishing in size, so you have a smaller pot of resources that is being competitively allocated across a broader need. And that makes it really challenging for the places that aren't San Francisco, that aren't New York City, that aren't Boston to compete and find the resources that they need in these smaller communities to get to a comprehensive project. I think some states are starting to think about creative ways to raise state funding. Hawaii passed a hotel tax that's going to be used for beach nourishment projects and beach restoration and coastal restoration projects. A lot of places are using disaster recovery dollars to capitalize state revolving funds to pay for flood resilience retrofits to businesses and homes. But, this is a big challenge, and, I don't know that anybody has really come up with good answers yet.
Two questions start here and then to that gentleman there.
So I guess I've just been thinking, since then, are any areas that have been hit thinking about not rebuilding or not rebuilding in the same way? And what is the wisdom of rebuilding in some of these areas that, Gregwell will continue to get hit? And I know there's huge insurance implications. And so I'm just wondering about it from that point of view.
Do you want to take
Right. The question is, yeah, retreat. Is that a viable option for some communities?
Yes, I look to the Netherlands. I mean, much of their country is already below sea level, and so they're in the forefront of this. And what are they thinking about the future? And I don't know the answer to that. Look at the Netherlands, where much of the country is already below sea level, that they are at the forefront of thinking about this problem and trying to understand what they're doing might be very helpful.
I think in New York and places that have heavy development and have a lot of tax base where they can engineer solutions and spend the money to protect themselves for flooding like the Netherlands, it's a different question. I think it's a much more existential question in places that can't afford, like the Eastern Shore of Maryland, where there, you know, there is no engineered solution. The whole place is, you know, very low and flat, and we're already starting to see like natural attritions as people's septic systems fail, as their homes become unsaleable. You're seeing abandoned homes in the Eastern Shore, but you know, I don't, again, this is a question that I don't think anybody has cracked the nut yet. It's a really hard question. These are people's homes. These are places where people have lived for generations. In Smith Island in Maryland, it's a historic waterman fishing community where people have lived for hundreds of years, and the families have stayed on, and they're starting to grapple with this question of when do we say enough is enough and try to figure out what the solution is. The National Disaster Resilience Competition for Louisiana included a relocation plan for the Ile de Jean Charles tribe, that's just south of Louisiana, and you know, has been losing land in the football fields for generations. And so part of their strategy is to try to figure out what a relocation plan would look like for that community and how to rebuild them in places that are upland but close enough to their tribal lands where they can still do, you know, fishing and the things that they've been doing for generations. But it's costly and it's not easy. And so we're starting the conversation, but it's, you know, just opening page one of the book.
Yeah, I would just add there are other places that are on the forefront of loss already, including Louisiana, including parts of Alaska and a number of Pacific Islands, where small communities are having to relocate whole cloth, and that's the front lines. It's a really sad front line, and I think as we think about some of our more developed cities, I think 5 or 6 years ago, before Hurricane Sandy and before, like when I first started talking about adaptation, working on adaptation, people were saying, "Don't say manage retreat. Don't say that. Like, it's not okay. It's not. People don't want to hear about that." And I think people want to talk about it actually now. It's like actually a thing where we have to talk about what that looks like. And then in terms of a resource that you might want to look into, my colleague who used to work with the Regional Plan Association in New York, in the New York area, the Regional Plan Association and Lincoln Institute of Land Policy, I think, just published either a book or a big paper on buyout programs. And I think they just published it like last week or 2 weeks ago or something. So it looks across the nation, I think, at buyout programs and things like rolling easements like you have in Texas and other things. I only know that it exists. I can't tell you what it says, but it might be of interest as you start to think about strategies for a managed planning of retreat, or of course the Netherlands option, which is where they've built all flood protection to a 1 in 10,000 year flood standard because that's just what they needed to do. Trade-offs there too, but that could be something you could look at in terms of some policy guidance.
We have about 5 minutes, so we have two questions there. Let's make the questions quick and the answers, and we'll get this gentleman, I think, was...
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Okay. I'll
if it were... Yeah, go.
Peter Thompson, Peter Rise of the World. Not to give a plug for our program, but we've just done a series called Living with Rising Seas that looks at the Netherlands, that looks at Tangier Island in
Virginia,
near Smith Island in Chesapeake Bay, looks at Ile de Jean Charles, and Richmond, Virginia, and a few other places that really tries to get inside some of these very questions. It's great. It just might be good reference for folks if you're interested.
That's great.
Okay. So just for the mic, PRI series, Living with Rising Seas as a resource. Thanks.
James Gannis, freelance. The first part of adaptation planning is essentially is risk analysis. And there are two kinds of risk, physical and economic risk. And the insurance companies are in the business of doing that risk analysis and charging people money to take the economic risk onto themselves. Are the insurance companies involved in any of the adaptation planning that you've been involved with?
People always ask me that question, and the question is, are insurance companies involved in adaptation planning, as obviously there's an economic risk that they're taking on? We have not had a lot of interaction with the insurance industry around this, although we like to remind people when they say, you know, we shouldn't talk about this. This is a dangerous and politically difficult topic. Well, the insurance industry is pretty hip to the topic before maybe the public officials are. And so I think that they've done some big reports. I think Swiss Re has done some big reports looking at global risk around it. And more locally in California, the Bloomberg and I forget who else, they did a big report a couple years ago called Risky Business that looked at the economic impacts of climate change in California and the challenges of insuring the future. So those are some resources, but it's not as though they are at least interacting at the policy table with many of us trying to help explain to us what the real costs are. I think they have perhaps a better bead on it than the public sector right now.
On the flood side, I mean, the challenge is that flood insurance is basically excluded from most policies, and the federal government has stepped in to subsidize flood insurance through the National Flood Insurance Program. So that's not a covered loss for them. They exclude it. I think most of the primary insurers, because they just don't cover flood risk, are not that worried about it. The reinsurance industry, which is insurance for insurers, is engaging on this. Munich Re does a lot of work around risk and resilience. Swiss Re works with 100 resilient cities, communities as one of their technical support teams. I think one of the big challenges with the insurance is that the modeling they do to figure out how to set rates is proprietary, and that's their competitive advantage against other insurers, and it's subject to all of the state regulation. So it's not something that they share, and I think there are folks like NOAA and Rockefeller that are trying to figure out how do we tap the knowledge of these reinsurance that have these incredibly sophisticated models to help state and local governments make better decisions. But I don't know that anybody's figured out how to do that without kind of hurting their business model.
So before we wrap up, I'll take the prerogative to ask the last question of all the panelists very quickly. Since this is, Susan was alluding to, this is a new challenging area for reporters on this beat, and we could start with Mark. You know, what can we do as news media to cover climate adaptation better, or at least differently? So 30 seconds or less, let's just go through, and then we'll wrap.
I guess I would say that with respect to forests and forest ecosystem management, there are two things. One is that our agencies have been a little slow to be responsive in thinking about how they manage their resources. And so, for example, I have a Forest Service colleague who got in a lot of trouble for being interviewed and publishing a paper last year about how the Forest Service has the capacity to change their fire management strategy to be a let-burn policy, but they haven't been able to do it because they can't give their resource managers the coverage that they would need to allow them to make that decision. It's a very risky decision for them professionally, and that's a big challenge. And then the other thing is thinking about how we engage socially in helping make these decisions for our natural resource management.
Thank you. Jessica.
I get the point earlier that we don't want to put audiences off by leading with climate, but I think the climate information is hugely important for people to understand that these are impacts that are happening and they're only going to happen more intensely and more frequently. And so, and you know, keeping these issues in the news, even though people may be getting flood fatigue and not wanting to see the disasters and the carnage and focusing on, you know, what movie stars are doing instead, but also telling the positive stories of what communities and states are doing to proactively address this threat and what are these projects that will lead to these multi-benefit results where you're getting flood risk reduction or climate adaptation benefits, but you're also getting new recreational space, you're protecting vulnerable populations, you're getting economic benefits from these projects. I think that's an important message to say, you know, these are dollars well spent.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would say without really knowing what the media market is like, I would say lead with hope and great stories of tools that are working. I kind of feel like the overwhelming level of gloom and doom embedded in any climate disaster story is a turnoff. I mean, there's so much of it now. It's very hard to, I think, sustain people's attention, even though it's really important, as Jessica said. I think maybe we live in a bubble where we're not debating climate change in the Bay Area anymore, so we don't have to say climate change is happening. Look, here's some examples of how climate change is happening. We do need to give people a sense that there's something that can be done about it, and that there are tools and there are models and design ideas that are precedents for the future. And so I think any more storytelling we can do around stories of hope are ones that we should focus on.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. And thank you to the panelists. Before you go, pass up the sensor, unless you plan on taking temperature readings. And thank you, Peter. And I've been asked to ask you to go to the ballroom where lunch is going to start. And it's going to start, I think, with a climate wrap. So
what?
RAP. So be sure not to miss that. So head on. Let's give a big thanks to the panelists.